Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 135 of The Infectious Myth. 135 is a fun number. It is 1 to the power of 1 plus 3 to the power of 2 plus 5 to the power of 3. And also, if you add 1 plus 3 plus 5 and multiply it by 1 times 3 times 5, you get 135. And for photographers, 135 was the cartridge format of 35 millimeter film introduced by Kodak in 1934 and used by most handheld cameras prior to digital and still available today. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We're now on Instagram as well with the same name at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.fm or download the program afterwards as an MP3 file. You can listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. phone number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you'd like to sponsor this show as an individual or advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like to me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of, on pretty much any topic, I'd be happy to discuss the opportunity with you. You can donate via PayPal using david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Go to theinfectiousmyth.com/donate.php for more information. I appreciate you listening. I also appreciate your financial support. And now let's go to this week's guest. Because of her story, we have to use the name Mary instead of her real name because her identity cannot be revealed publicly. Today's guest we're going to call Mary. We're not using her real name because of her personal experiences with a family member accused of shaken baby syndrome. She not only learned a lot about the individual case, of course, but has become involved since then in studying the issue in detail and assisting others accused of similar crimes, usually unfounded. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Thank you.
Now, can you explain what is often called the triad of shaken baby syndrome or abusive head trauma that's used by doctors and others who believe in it?
Yes, there are three symptoms that are invisible to the eye that doctors will say or expert child abuse pediatricians will say point only to the mechanism of shaking. One of them is retinal hemorrhages, and that's often called a telltale symptom. Whenever a doctor looks in a child's eyes and sees retinal hemorrhages, and that's bleeding in the back of the eye, he or she will suspect that the child may have been shaken by the last person with them, and then they'll they will report that. Now, another one of them is subdural hemorrhaging, which is bleeding on the surface of the brain. Again, these are technical medical terms, but that's basically what it means. And the third one is brain swelling. And it's neither retinal hemorrhages nor subdural hemorrhages are really dangerous to a person. People have them all the time, even without knowing it. But the brain swelling, especially in a child, tends to kind of take on a life of its own, and the brain continues to swell and swell and swell until the child dies, and it's very difficult for them to get that stopped. And so that's what causes the handicapping effects of what they believe to be shaken baby syndrome, and also death in a child is that brain swelling.
Right, and do the serious symptoms usually come on quickly, or is there a variety of different timings for the time between when the child seems to be okay and when the child collapses or even dies?
Well, that's what, they will testify in court that it is immediate, that when the child is shaken, they will immediately show severe symptoms. But there are cases, known cases, One case in Wisconsin, a child came in to the hospital that had, they believed, had been abused. She had bruises and other indications. Some of these children have nothing other than these invisible symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And they admitted her because they were concerned about abuse. And they called in the police to photograph the child and so on. It wasn't until, I think it was 14 hours later, that the child started to have breathing problems and subsequently died with the triad. So that case alone, to me, indicates that they cannot say for sure that it's the last person with the child who is responsible.
That's actually an important issue, which I hadn't really thought of before. But before we get to some of these specific details, can you describe your personal situation with shaken baby syndrome, the situation within your family?
Yes, our daughter-in-law just was so happy when she became a mom. I mean, sometimes you don't really know what your gift is or your calling, but for her, it really was being a mom. She loved being a mom. And when it came time for her to go back to work, our son came home, and she was crying, and he said, what's the problem? And she says, well, I really don't want to go back to work. I want to stay home with my son. And he said, well, if you really want to do that, well, let's figure out a way to make it happen. And, I mean, he went to the nth degree to make it possible for them to survive on just that one salary, and so she could stay home with the kids. That's what she really wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so proud of him for doing that. I mean, that's a real man in my view, you know?
Yeah.
He really stepped up, and, you know, he would have been okay with her going back to work, too, but she wanted to stay home with the kids. And then she had a daughter 2 years later, and sometime during that, a friend from church asked her if she could watch her two kids. And they were all friends, and so she agreed to do that. And she got the license, even though it's just two kids. You know, she went through all the rigmarole and declared the tax income and the whole bit. And it was that little boy. And she became concerned after she took the kids in. She became concerned that there was something really wrong going on in that home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were just a little clues. You know how it is sometimes that you just don't really, you can't put your finger on it.
Right.
You know, even in case of the older children just slapping the baby when they walk by the crib. And so she was talking to people. She was saying, I really want to, you know, stop doing this. I just don't feel comfortable with this situation. I'm wondering if I should report this person, even though she's my friend, for child abuse. But anyway, during that whole course of her reevaluating this, and she had told or given notice, and the woman just begged her, oh, the kids love you, and so on. So anyway, she kept going with it, and one day she didn't have the kids on a Tuesday. On a Wednesday, the children came in early. They were still asleep. And when the baby woke up, things weren't right.
Mm-hmm.
He later that afternoon had a seizure and subsequently died. And so she was accused of killing him because she was the last person who had care of him.
Okay, so that's in that case, that was a big issue. And so,
yes.
Obviously, if shaken baby syndrome is what a lot of doctors say it is, you pick up the baby, you shake it violently, the baby starts to experience these symptoms right away, then you can say the last person must have been the person who did this. But what you're pointing out is that sometimes these symptoms take hours, many hours, to surface. And even if they're caused by shaking, it's not necessarily the last person.
Right. There are so many holes in the theory, and that's a big hole. Because they usually, in our case, they did not even investigate the family at all.
And do you believe...
They assumed from the beginning that our daughter-in-law was lying and that the baby's family, all of them, were telling the truth, rather than trying to ferret out who might be lying.
Right, or nobody.
I mean, we don't know. We don't know what happened to that baby. I wish we did, you know.
Yes. I think that's an important point, because there are cases where the choice is a caregiver harmed the baby, or there was something medically wrong with the baby that caused these symptoms that had nothing to do with abuse. I mean, those are often the two choices. In this case, it seems like, you know, maybe her instincts about the family were right, or maybe there was something wrong with the baby.
Right, yes.
And
none of those were even investigated, because the fact is that the theory, or the idea, the hypothesis, rules. And so you know, the answers are already all there in their minds. The last person with the child shook the child if these symptoms are evident.
Right. And I think most people have watched too many television shows where, you know, they come in, they take some samples, they put it through some magic machine, and then, you know, they can tell everything about what happened, who did it, when, all this kind of stuff. But as we know now, forensic evidence is often flawed based on bad science, or even there's been cases with the FBI where a lot of it was just faked within the FBI laboratory. I forget whether that was like shoe prints or something, bite marks or something. It's either been shown to be based on bad science or in the lab, they just want to produce the right results, even if that's not what the machines are saying.
Exactly. People will justify. I mean, if they truly believe that this horrible thing has happened and it is because of a person, they will justify even lying. I mean, there's a word for it, test of lying.
Test of lying,
perjumony.
Yes.
I've heard words.
Perjumony, yes.
You know, yeah, where they will justify that because the end result would be to get this bad person off the street. But it kind of depends how much they pursue the things that are questionable. It kind of depends on the severity or how the alleged crime is perceived by society. And hurting or killing a baby is probably the worst thing anyone can be accused of.
Yeah, and yeah, and that's how you can make a hard-bitten policeman get all upset, is if you abuse of a child, a physical abuse, sexual abuse, a child dying. That's difficult. I was actually just reading about a woman policeman who has a dog whose role is to give comfort to paramedics who've just been at, say, a young person's suicide or something like that. It's pretty hard for adults to take that because you think about your own children, I'm sure. But that doesn't mean that your hypothesis is correct about what
exactly
happened.
Exactly. And see, that's part of the problem is it's very difficult for jurors. For one thing, they don't understand the medicine. I mean, everybody assumes that if somebody's accused of something so horrible, there must be some evidence. And they don't understand the medicine, so it's sort of like, do I believe this doctor or that doctor? And it's really hard because most jurors have children. They love their children. And I don't, you know, what makes this such a tragedy is I don't think anybody or very few people are intentionally doing anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody is out there to try to, you know, ruin families, which is what happens when these accusations
mm-hmm.
are made.
Yes.
Or trying to, you know, by trying to kind of overreach, it ends up ruining families and ruining children's lives. Our grandchildren were abused by the system, by the state.
So what? Okay, so let's go through what happened. I'd like to ask some more questions about other cases, but so she was accused. I mean, what was the accusation? I mean, was it murder?
Manslaughter. Oftentimes it is murder, but in her case, it was manslaughter. And what they do with murder, you know. Again, these things have changed over time. It used to be that to have a murder accusation, you had to prove intent, that the person intended to kill someone. But now what they have is what's called felony murder. And felony murder means if you're in the process of committing a felony of some other kind and a murder occurs, you don't have to prove intent that the person would be killed.
So they would say if you were shaking the child, that's child abuse. And so therefore, if you kill a child while you're doing that, that's murder, not manslaughter.
Right, and then they don't have to prove intent to the jury. They just have to prove that another felony was in the process of being committed.
Right. Okay, so then did she go to court in this case?
Yes. She was indicted a few days later. Actually, the police came that very night, even before the baby died, in the middle of the night, and they let them in, which is a big mistake. Anytime there's a possibility you could be accused of something, even if you didn't do it, I mean, most of the protections are there really to protect innocent people, but innocent
mm-hmm.
people think it's safe to talk to the police, and so
right.
she talked to the police. And then that was kind of twisted, and they said she confessed, whereas, you know, when you listen to the tape, fortunately there was a tape.
Mm-hmm.
They said, no, she didn't confess. But, of course, that's what hit the newspapers, is that she had confessed. And then that's also what they told the medical examiner, and so he didn't need to do any more tests. He already had the answer, and, you know, so there's no critical thinking once this ball starts rolling.
Right. So what did she say that was that you think was misinterpreted as a confession? Like,
Let's see. They said they asked a two-part question. I'm trying to remember exactly. It was something like, well, after you shook him, did he stop crying? And she said he stopped crying.
Right, which is a trap,
Shook him, but she said he stopped crying. So, and she was crying at this time because they had just told her that this child she loved may not make it, that this was much more serious than, you know, anybody suspected when he was rushed to the hospital.
Right. So they claim to have a confession, so we don't really need a lot of medical evidence in that case. And but I think in this case it didn't end up with a conviction. So how did that?
Oh no, it did end up with. She was convicted.
She was. Yes. Oh my God! So she was convicted of manslaughter, which is yes. What's the sentence for manslaughter? That's years.
Well, the maximum is 20 years, but because of her perfect record, the judge was very merciful. Also, I think because it wasn't in the headlines, because at the time there was a major incident going on in the world that was claiming all the headlines. And so we were kind of on the back page. And so there wasn't a public outcry for the maximum sentence.
Mm.
But, you know, that was just luck. I mean, we had a three-year wait for the trial. And that was 3 years where she couldn't live with the children. We did manage to get her to be able to live with us and have the children be here as long as we were present, you know, and that was only after a year of having the kids out of state. It's a mess.
And again,
what do you tell your kids? What do you tell your kids? They were there. They witnessed the whole thing. They knew what happened and didn't happen.
Right.
They're too young, really, to be witnesses. You know.
Yeah. They're not going to be taken seriously. But I mean, that must be very traumatic for her children.
Oh, traumatic.
Yes.
Yeah, for a child to lose a parent, even if it's like cancer or something, is one of the most traumatic things that can happen.
Right. And this is almost worse than that because you don't know if it's going to end up with you never seeing your mother again or if she's going to come back. And so did she was convicted and sent to jail then for how long?
Yes. She was in prison somewhat over 2 years. It was a 10-year sentence with some suspended and then with probation and blah, 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 you know, parole and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, she actually spent a couple of years. A little more than 2 years in prison, which is very short for manslaughter. I mean, I thank that judge. He is what made it possible for the family to reconstitute. The kids are now well bonded to their parents. It's a wonderful family.
And when she came out, was she still, I mean, she was on parole, so was she allowed to be back with her family then? Or
Yes. She had to report to a parole officer, but there was a day, you know, they told the kids, that they promised them, Mama will come home.
Right.
If you know, fortunately, that promise actually came true, and I think the kids trust their parents more than they might have otherwise. You know, for sure than if that promise had not been fulfilled. That was a great day.
Well, anything could have gone wrong. I mean, she could have been, kept in jail longer because of some perceived violation of prison rules or something like that.
Many people receive, 20 years is kind of a low average, I'd say. Many people receive life sentences on this, or 50-year sentences. They're just draconian.
Yes. I mean, if it was true, it'd be one thing. But if there's questions about the scientific basis for this, that's a completely different thing. And I mean,
even if it was true, though, a lot of people who are accused have, you know, done years and years of child care with no problems, no incidents. Mm-hmm. Even if one day they got super stressed and shook a child, I mean, I think that means they shouldn't be able to do child care anymore, but a life sentence?
Yeah, I agree with you that, especially in America, sentences are completely out. And there's sort of this idea that people are completely are not possibly able to recover, not able to be rehabilitated, I guess that's what I'm trying to say. And therefore, you got to basically slam them in jail for the rest of their lives. But people make terrible mistakes. Of course, we're jumping to the conclusion that in cases where it was really child abuse. So can you give me an example of another case outside of your family where it seemed likely that the reason for the child's death had nothing to do with abuse but was caused by something else.
Well, there are some cases that it's proven to have been caused by something else.
Okay, well, that would be a good example.
Okay. Wonderful, yeah. I mean, one of them, I saw a picture, and this was a grandma who had done child care for years and years, and I track these with Google News Alerts. I keep up on what's going on. And, her face, they tracked her down in a different city visiting her daughter, and the baby had fallen from the changing table.
Right.
And then later had, seized and took him into the hospital, and he died. But, I tried to follow. I kept Googling her name, trying to figure out what happened. And finally, eventually, years later, I saw an article where what had happened was another family in that same city had had a child with glutaric aciduria, which is a condition. It's a congenital condition that causes, in certain cases, for the blood to become acidic and then kind of eat through the vessels and bleed. And that person had called her lawyer when they saw that case and said, please do a test to find out if this is the case. And it was the case. So in that case, she had been accused. She had been, I don't know if she was out on bail or if she went to jail. Most people go to jail for at least a little while, before they bail out. And but fortunately, there was another family that took the trouble to call her attorney and said, please check for this. And so, she was cleared. Another case, a mother had been accused of shaking her baby, and her other children were taken away and adopted out. She later had another baby in a different state with the same man, and that child displayed the same symptoms. And she went to they went to the doctor, and he had just been to a medical convention where he had learned about a condition called Mankey's syndrome, or Mankey's disease.
Right.
And the child had wiry hair, and that's one of the symptoms of this congenital condition.
Mm-hmm.
So he did a test on that baby and found out that baby did have that, and it has the same symptoms as shaken baby syndrome. They went back and they exhumed the body of the first child and found out that he, too, had this congenital condition.
Well.
And so even though there are still people, she says that she's still suspected in the county, the prosecutor did not press charges. Oftentimes, they'll press charges anyway. They'll say, that doesn't, just because this child had a medical condition that fully accounts, doesn't mean he wasn't abused. And it's true. It doesn't mean that. It doesn't prove he wasn't abused.
Right. But, I mean, let's talk about differential diagnosis, because that's sort of the theory about what happens when you have a mysterious death, right? A young child dies. And so the question is, there's a thousand things that this, without really knowing this at first, you don't really know what it is. There could be thousands of things it could be. So how do you narrow that down to one or a couple of causes that are much more likely?
Well, what doctors tend to do, and because, there's not unlimited money for doing a million tests,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What they tend to do is they'll say, rule out shaken baby syndrome. That's their first guess of what they think is most likely happened. And then they might list other things underneath there. But oftentimes, unless they can rule it out, and I don't know how on earth you would do that, because you'd have to prove what actually happened. How can a person who, if they say, did you shake the baby? Oftentimes people will say yes. And the reason is when the child collapses and quits breathing, you'll say, baby, wake up. I mean, it's a natural reaction.
I know that if I looked at a baby and the baby didn't seem to be breathing, I would shake the baby, and if the baby, if the baby then cried, I would put my hand on my heart and take a deep breath and go, thank God there was nothing wrong with the baby. But that is totally a natural reaction. You want to, get the baby to prove to you that there's nothing wrong because you've got this scare.
You're
and sometimes,
in a panic. You're
yeah,
in panic.
And sometimes babies are so in such a deep sleep, they don't appear to be really breathing. So that probably happens quite often with babies who are perfectly healthy. Just in such a deep sleep, mom or dad can't tell that they're breathing.
Passed out for some reason. I mean, I passed out a few years ago from something, and my I woke to my, or I came back to consciousness with my husband yelling, call 911, call 911 to our neighbor. And I said, did you shake me? And he said, you know, I did. Because it's just natural. And so then when a person says, yes, I shook the baby, because they're not aware that they're meaning shaking violently,
right,
and aggressively. They don't know that. They're just telling the truth. They shook the baby. Then that means it's not ruled out. And then it goes to the cops, and then they never even test for the other things. I wrote to the American Academy of Pediatrics years ago, and I said there should be a protocol where all these things have to be tested. Even though they're maybe very minor incidents, we don't know how minor the incidence is how small the incidence is among people with these symptoms of the disease. A certain disease may be very, very rare, but among the people who have the symptoms of that disease, it's not quite so rare. So
that's
they should
true.
Check for it before accusing, and they never even answered.
Yeah, that's the general attitude of a scientific organization to people who are challenging one of its favorite dogmas is basically ignore you because you don't have a PhD or an MD or whatever, so they can do that. And even if you did have a PhD or an MD, there's not any guarantee that they'd take you seriously.
No, there are a lot of doctors who seriously question this shaken baby dogma that's been taught in medical schools since the 90s. And a lot of them are just saying, hey, listen, you know, I've been a pediatrician to this family for years. This person did not do that. But they are afraid to speak out against the powerful child abuse doctors.
Right. Now, I you're probably aware, even though this happened in Canada, of the Charles Smith case.
Oh, yes.
Yes. How could you not be?
I had hope back then that actually things might change. But no, I mean, there's been challenge after challenge after challenge that's gone to that degree. How much money did Canada spend on that? And yet, nothing really changed. Canadians are still being accused on the same basis.
They managed to basically say that it wasn't really shaken baby syndrome that was on trial. It was Charles Smith. And so basically every case in which he testified is now questionable, and that's a lot of cases. And he was in Ontario, which is, I think, almost 40% of Canada's population. And he was in Toronto, which is the biggest city in Ontario.
And the biggest children's hospital.
The biggest children's hospital. And children come to that hospital from all over Canada, maybe other countries as well. So he had a very, very powerful position, but they basically said, okay, bad doctor, get rid of Charles Smith, now everything's okay. But I think one of the recommendations of what was called the Googe Inquiry, which is they probably spent millions of dollars into looking into what went wrong with Charles Smith, was that the defendants should have access to expert testimony.
Right.
And what is the situation with that?
Well, there actually, even in the United States, there are more states that are saying that without some expert, because the whole thing hinges on expert testimony.
Right.
It's all the opinions of doctors. There's no other evidence. The only evidence is these symptoms that they see. And believe me, they don't have to see all three of them. If they see one of them, they'll call it a shaken.
Oh, really?
Oftentimes, yeah.
So it's a triad, but you only need one leg of this.
You don't have to have a triad. One or two legs will do.
It's a magic stool that stands up on one leg.
Yeah, but even here, they're saying that, you know, some cases are getting overturned because they said the defendant did not have access to an expert. But having access to an expert doctor does not mean you're going to win at trial, even if you're innocent, because it's that doctor then speaking against the, and then the state, once you get an expert for a defense, they're going to line up as many experts as they can manage.
Right.
You know, and they have state money, so they can do that. And so it's like, well, do we believe these four doctors, or do we believe this one doctor? Do we believe these 10 doctors, or these two?
Right.
And then they'll always bring up, oh, you're being paid by the defense. Well, I mean, the doctors can't work for free to examine the medical records and go through things. And actually, the state doctors are being paid. They're just being paid as part of their profession. You know, it's not like they're doing it for free either. But they'll bring that up like, well, because you're being paid, your testimony is corrupt. You know, you're just saying what you're saying because you're being paid.
Right, right.
And so the jurors, you know, when they see all that, again, there's, you know, in these cases, the presumption is of guilt, not of innocence.
Yeah, I mean, if you testify, if you are a doctor who has a lot of questions about shaking baby syndrome, you're always going to be testifying for the defense, right? And you're also, that means you're always going to be paid because you can't afford to live otherwise. right? If you're doing this. And so they can use this against you. You always testify for the defense, right? You've got
some
an axe to grind.
The people who do testify for the defense, most of them at one time testified for the prosecution. Mm-hmm. And then as cases went on, they're beginning to question it. And then they start digging deeper. And then they say, there's really nothing underneath this.
Right.
There's no real science. It's just assumptions and presuppositions and so on. But then they end up being called on because there's so few of them that can afford to risk their career by testifying for the defense. Most of them are retired. But a lot of them now, in order to avoid this, some of them are offering to testify for free. But they'll use that against you. Oh, you're testifying for free. You're an advocate.
Right.
So no matter what you do, you lose, you know?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, I think the whole business of having experts hired by the prosecution or defense is a problem because, you know, if you're working for the prosecution, you naturally, it's difficult to not kind of want your side to win. And the idea of an expert witness is that you're neutral, even though one side is paying your fees. That's difficult for somebody to maintain that.
There have been proposals, I think in England, there have been some proposals that expert witnesses be hired by the court rather than by mm-hmm. prosecution and defense. But that doesn't really work either because the child abuse pediatricians will say, we're the only experts.
Right.
And they're basically an arm of the prosecution, even though they're, quote, doctors, they're pediatricians. Everybody thinks pediatricians, you know, I mean, who could be more white and pure than a pediatrician, you know? You remember your own pediatrician and how much you loved him, and these are pediatricians, but they're child abuse pediatricians, and their job is to get, to save. I think they see their job as kind of a messianic role of saving children from abusive situations.
Well, I think that was definitely the case with Charles Smith, who was apparently very religious and sort of saw this as his crusade, that he was going to act like God and smote these right. evil parents who were abusing their children.
Make the world a better place.
Yes.
A safer place for children. I mean, that is a real ideal. And there's what's called noble cause corruption. And what that is that you will justify the means because your end is so noble. And
right.
I think that's what's happened, is this has crept into where people are sure that even lying is okay because the cause is noble. I think some of the people who are involved in child abuse pediatrics and in child abuse work have been abused as children. They know it's real.
Right.
It's real and painful and personal. And they want to somehow make it better. They want to redeem the pain that they felt by going out there and saving other children.
And so it's not even
that they're evil, you know? It's an evil thing that's happening, but not so much by evil people necessarily.
Well, I think that's important to point out that I take it you don't deny that child abuse exists.
Oh, how can anybody deny
right,
that?
Yeah. Right. So,
yes.
So how would you tell the difference between a case where real child abuse has occurred and in the case of when only the triad or maybe only one leg of the triad is present, as you say, these invisible symptoms which are visible only upon a postmortem in many cases?
Well, sometimes, yeah, or at least with CTs and MRIs.
Right. So some kinds of scans.
Whatever. Mm-hmm. But yes, you know, the problem is, and this is a real problem, and I struggle with this, the problem is you can't always tell.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in I've got a bunch of cases I collect when I do these news alert things, and in a lot of them, I'll tell you, I don't know if the person's guilty or innocent. Some of them I strongly suspect guilt. And, you know, doctors that do testify for the defense, they turn down cases that they truly believe, you know, their gut feeling is it's guilt. But, you know, our justice system is supposed to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt before you're incarcerated. And that should mean that when there's doubt, even guilty people may not be punished for something they've done.
Right. I to put it another way, I think our society has decided in theory that it's better to let a few guilty people walk free than it is to put innocent people in jail or even to execute them in cases where
right.
people are accused
theory,
of murder.
In theory,
but in practice,
yeah.
I think that's not the case. I think that the courts, we know that they put a lot of innocent people in jail for a lot of different crimes that never happened.
And the thing is, a lot of guilty people go free. What seems to make the difference is how heinous the crime is. If it's a truly heinous crime, and Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld's book, Actual Innocence, when I read that, I remember being so shocked when I first heard that there are guilt, the DNA has proven that some of these people on death row are innocent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I knew that a lot of times the court just slaps people on the hand and lets them go. But those are generally small cases, like, you know, thefts or kind of small things. On big things, people, there is just this desire for justice, for revenge, for retribution, for somebody to pay. This horrible crime has happened. Somebody's got to pay.
Right.
And so that tends to blind people to whether this particular person that's been accused is the one who did it.
Right, right.
And in shaken baby cases, even if there was a crime at all. I mean, it's really, if there's not a crime at all, you can't just prove that somebody else did it.
Well, and I think maybe ego gets in there, too, because if you're a prosecutor and it's like, yes, we're going to send the person who murdered this baby to jail, and then it's like, well, actually, the baby wasn't murdered. It was something else. That's right. A real step down for the prosecutor. And I mean, prosecutors, are, you know, they're not supposed to be focused on sending people to jail. They're supposed to be focused on justice.
Yes.
But the fact that people need to talk so much about prosecutors should be focused on justice, and if they see an injustice, they should overturn it. I mean, that doesn't happen very often.
No, it doesn't. It does happen, though.
Yes.
But it is rare. I talked to one prosecutor from Minnesota, and her office had actually initiated, and this is one of the only times this has happened, they initiated DNA reviews once DNA became available of all the questionable cases where DNA might be able to prove innocence. And they did find, on the prosecutors initiated it.
Yes.
In general, people go back and they fight, and they can't even get the evidence released to prove the person was innocent. On DNA cases, which are clear.
Yes, yes. I mean, that
the shaken baby stuff is not clear in general. You know, you can't be sure that it's not shaken. But I would say that if ever you just have retinal hemorrhages, subdural and brain swelling, and no bruising, and no other indications that it should be highly suspect. I think there's probably something they don't know. There's some either congenital condition or there's some environmental thing. There's something they don't yet know.
Well, one thing I've thought of and has been sort of raised in some cases is adverse reactions to pharmaceuticals or vaccines, because these symptoms you're describing are basically, if you have a lot of internal bleeding, you're also potentially going to get swelling. If you have an allergic reaction internal to your body, you would expect to get symptoms like this.
Right. And some children, this is as a result within a couple, 3 days, usually it's not immediately, so they don't have to pay, you know, the vaccines don't take responsibility, but within 2 or 3 days of having vaccinations.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes those children are sickly already. I mean, my advice would be to anybody, if you have a premature baby, get them vaccinated as, you know, on the time schedule as if they had been born at term. Don't vaccinate early, because all those organs, everything's still developing. And, you know, they'll vaccinate based on 3 months after the day they were born, and that they shouldn't do that. Also, if your child is sick, delay the vaccinations.
Right.
Because those things tend to go together a lot of times.
Yeah, I think that's sane advice. And, I mean, one of the problems with preemies is that the vaccine dose is not adjusted for the body weight of the child. And, I mean, that, I think, should be looked into, because you could have, you know, preemies. I mean, there's probably like a 10-to-1 difference between the weight of a preemie, a very early preemie, and a bruiser baby that's like over 10 pounds. And obviously, any use of pharmaceutical drugs or vaccines, if it's not adapted for the body size, could have devastating consequences.
Right. And, you know, even though vaccines don't affect everyone the same way, and, you know, a lot of people are just fine, that doesn't mean it's the same thing about maybe there's, you know, a small group of people that they're just, you know, it's that are either allergic or there's some kind of a natural reason that they cannot just survive that without damage, you know?
Yeah, well, one
not
thing.
Everybody, but,
right. One thing I read with vaccines, there's still some vaccines that contain mercury, like the flu vaccine. And apparently the amount of mercury in the shot varies depending on whether it's the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth in the bottle. right? The mercury tends to settle to the bottom. So if you get the bottom, the last one in the bottle, you might get more mercury than the first one. It makes sense, but who would think, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, they found one time there were all these infections coming in the hospital. They cleaned everything. They found out it was coming through the air vent above the light or something. I mean, there's things you got to keep looking until you find the answers. And you can't say, well, this is impossible. This couldn't possibly be it.
Yeah, and to say we're going to rule out shaken baby syndrome is not differential diagnosis. I mean, diagnosis should be, here's, we got a short list of symptoms. Here's all the things it could be. And then it could be, well, if it's this congenital disorder, we could do a blood test to rule that out, right? And then you get rid of that, right?
Right.
Do a blood test.
But like I said, I still think that there are things that they don't know. I hope someday somebody gets of the children that have these symptoms, gets a genetic sample from each one of them and starts looking. Are there some commonalities maybe in the DNA that could indicate some disease that we don't know or some allergy or something that we don't yet know? When they think they have the answer, and they think they have the answer with shaken baby syndrome, they quit looking. And I think children are dying because they're no longer looking for what might really be causing these things.
And let's talk about people who plead guilty, because I think it's difficult for people to understand why someone would plead guilty to something they didn't do. But you talked about something called the Reed technique. Can you explain what that is and how it could lead to a false guilty plea?
Actually, back in the 40s, they would torture people or beat them or whatever, or deprive them of food or whatever for a long time in order to get confessions. And that's happened throughout history. In order, confessions are very powerful. Well, the Reed technique was developed as a way to break down hardened criminals into telling the, quote, the truth, but basically into confessing. And when it is used on babysitters and grandmothers and young parents who've never had any bad dealings with the police, who think the police are there to help and they're to protect and, which they are, but in this case, if you're suspected, they're going to play a different role with you. People break down and confess to just about anything to get out of the room. And later on, they'll deny that. They'll say, no, I didn't do it. Well, you said you did, and they'll go with that. And, when they think you're guilty, a good interrogator can get a confession from almost anyone.
So
and
how...
I don't think that could happen to us, but it could.
Yeah, I've never been interrogated by the police. I guess crossing the border, it sometimes seemed like that, but luckily, not too bad. So how does the technique work, and how does this lead to false confessions?
Well, they break down a person's resistance for one thing. That you know the little room with no pictures on the wall, and you're in there, and it kind of creates a different reality for people. But they keep asking the same questions over and over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And also, then they will present they'll present a more innocent explanation. Well, we understand you're under a lot of stress, you've got all these bills, and anybody in that situation would be tempted.
Oh, I see. So it's like we understand that people get upset and you might shake your baby.
Yeah, it's kind of the good cop, bad cop thing. They get me on TV. And basically what they'll do is they'll give people a stark choice between what's seeming more innocent, and they'll say, we'll help you. Or oftentimes it'll be a threat, like, you'll never see your kids again unless we can get this straight.
Right.
Or the parent will be saying, I want to be with my baby. I want to be with my child. He's sick. And they'll say, either your wife did this or you did it.
Right.
The doctors say that this couldn't have happened from the story you're telling us.
Right.
That's the bad cop thing. And then the good cop comes in and says, well, we really understand. And we can try to help you. And they can lie. They can say that your wife... People don't know that police can lie in interrogations, but they can. They're allowed to in order to get at the, quote, the truth. They can say they have evidence they don't have. So they can say, well, your wife just said that, that you did it and she saw it. They can say that even if it's not true.
Okay.
And it makes a person get to a point of hopelessness where they perceive that their only way out of this room is to say or do whatever the cops want them to do. And that technique has the Reed people who... developed it. It's quite effective with hardened criminals. They have said from the beginning, you need to corroborate this. Don't take these confessions as real unless you have corroboration.
And that's not done.
You can't do that with chicken baby, really. The corroboration is the baby has these symptoms.
Right, right.
That's it. So. And that's all they need. I mean, they'll say in trial that the baby's body speaks volumes. The baby can't tell you what happened, but his body tells you what happened.
I mean, it's seen, Reed is seen as a better technique. And I guess compared to slamming somebody's head into the wall or
it
putting electric cattle prods on their testicles, I guess it is a less abusive technique, but it's still abusive.
Well, you know, sometimes they do get confessions from real criminals using that technique. And real criminals, of course, they're liars. I mean, police deal with liars all the time. And so if they have a suspect, they assume from the beginning that suspect is lying. Even if the little old grandma who's accused of shaking a baby.
And I mean, if you can verify it, like if you can trick somebody into revealing the location of the body and you go there and you find the murdered person,
right?
You know, I think we could all forgive them.
Corroboration.
Right?
Yes.
You've corroborated it. Who he could not have known that the body was 100 meters from the road in the swamp unless he put it there, right? That's fine. But in a case where you can't corroborate this, then that's a problem. Also, this business of shaking, like, do they turn the fact that, you know, the baby was unresponsive, you shook the baby to see if you bring some life, does that sort of get turned into, you know, I shook the baby, maybe I actually did harm the baby?
What they call that is minimization. In other words, any criminal will minimize what they did. And so they'll call that saying you shook the baby to revive him was minimizing, or, you know, you're twisting the story. You're acknowledging it. You're admitting it, but you're twisting it to make it seem like it was an innocent.
So I might say I just tapped him on the head with a lead pipe. I couldn't have possibly smashed his head in. But you have
by mistake, the thing fell on him, you know.
Right.
Whatever, yeah.
But the guy has a cracked skull and the lead pipe with my fingerprints on it beside it. Okay. I understand that, but in this case, maybe it was just the kind of shake you'd give to a baby when you're worried.
Back to the pleading guilty as well. Some 99% of cases in America end with a plea bargain.
Mm.
And I don't know how this stacks up in other countries, but the reason for that is that if you go to trial, you know, so only what? Maybe less than 5% or less than 3% actually go to trial. And most people don't realize that. But a plea bargains, they will overcharge, like they'll charge murder, and then they'll say, well, plea bargain it down to involuntary manslaughter, and you'll only get 10 years versus life. How many people could say no if they look at the record of how many convictions come with shaken baby? Nearly all of them are convictions.
Right, so if they
say no, you know, that at least gives them some hope that someday maybe they'll be able to go home.
Right, I mean, if you're offered 2 years if you plead guilty, and we're going to go for 20 if you don't.
Right.
I can see people breaking down and
not
and
only
that,
but, you know, to defend these cases takes tens of thousands of dollars. I think a minimum would be $50,000. Well, a lot of young families just don't have that kind of money. And even their families, you know, without mortgaging the house and or whatever, they don't have that kind of money. And so people will put it all in the balance. You know, if I'm ever going to see my kids again, I better plead guilty. If I'm ever going to be able to, you know, to work to support them or try to rebuild our family, you know, so the kids can go to college or whatever, I'm going to have to plead guilty. And then also, you know, they will tell the wife, for example, if a husband is accused, they'll tell the wife, if you don't divorce your husband or testify against him, we're going to take your children, because that means you're supporting the child abuser and you're permitting those children to be abused. They put tremendous pressures on people.
Right, right, to get the whole thing to crack until they get what they want.
Right, exactly.
And then it's all nice and tidy for them, and then, you know, they don't care about the fact that a family has been destroyed.
The mother of the baby never believed that she did it, as far as I know. I think she may reluctantly have come to that. They gave her free counseling where they tried to, you know, pour fuel on the flames of her resentment or, you know, to get her to blame our daughter-in-law.
And that's probably
quite... They did everything they could to turn her against her. And she finally did, because they said, otherwise we're going to accuse you of perjury, because she had perjured herself.
So she testified against your daughter-in-law?
Yes. Well, she just testified. But, right. Yeah, basically what she had originally told the police is that the children had been home alone the day before under the care of an 8-year-old, three little ones under the care of an 8-year-old.
Right.
And so she realized when this whole thing started that, you know, she could get in trouble for that.
Right, so she denied
it. So she lied and said that they had been under the care of an aunt.
Right.
And then, but when it came time to trial, the first trial was a mistrial because the aunt came up there and she says, no, I didn't see the kids all day.
Right.
And she had said that in grand jury and, you know, whatever. So anyway, but they never went back and said, well, maybe we should question this mother. We know she's told one lie. I mean, maybe she's telling some other lies. Who knows?
Yeah, yes.
They never questioned her.
So if you are accused or someone you know is accused of shaken baby syndrome, what are the things that you should do to,
see an attorney immediately? An attorney immediately. Don't talk to any officials. Don't talk to a pediatrician. Don't talk to a policeman. And believe me, they'll corner you right in the emergency room.
Mm-hmm.
And be very nice. What happened? Oh, we're concerned about the baby. What happened? You want to tell the story, but don't say a word. They twist everything against you. You know, and they'll call it an interview when it actually becomes an interrogation. An interview is just trying to find the truth, you know, whereas an interrogation is trying to get a confession. They'll turn from one to the other quickly. Just immediately get an attorney and close your mouth. Don't say a word.
Right.
Just say, I think I'll take advantage of those Miranda rights. Miranda came into being because of the Reed technique. They were getting so many false confessions that they finally said, you're going to have to tell people you can use this against them.
Right.
You know, they're stumbling right into false accusations and true accusations, you know, or true confessions.
So your right is you don't have to say anything unless you got an attorney present.
Right. And that's your only protection. There have been people, there was one in Minnesota where I talked to the attorney and he said, if she hadn't come to me right away, she would be in prison right now. But she was acquitted. And the reason was she never said anything. Think about JonBenet Ramsey. They later found out, well, I don't know, they're still all up in the air, I guess.
I have no idea what...
The parents didn't do it. But those parents, if they had said anything to officials, it would have been used against them, and they
right.
would have been... They just got attorneys and shut their mouths. And even though their lives were pretty much destroyed with this false accusation and all these, you know, innuendos and everything, at least they didn't go to prison. And
yeah.
Later, somebody looked back at the evidence and found DNA that belonged to somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting case because for people. That was in the 90s. It's a long time ago. I still occasionally see mentions of it. But the fact that those parents dressed up their little girl like was a model was...
A lot of people were critical of that, and with good reason. But that doesn't mean they killed her.
That, exactly, right. Like, it's most people would say, you know, that's kind of child abuse. You're sexualizing a six-year-old or however JonBenet Ramsey was. But that doesn't prove... that you're going to kill your own child, right? That does not follow. And yet, being able to use that, I was reading another case of where there was a fire, and the question was, similar to shaken baby syndrome, the question was, is it a crime like arson, or was it just a fire? In which case, nobody's guilty. And the woman in this case, when her house burned down, she tried to defraud the insurance company. You know, she said there was stuff in the house that wasn't there. Well, that doesn't prove that she killed her own children by burning the house down, but it was used against her, right? If you're going to lie about what was in the house, then why wouldn't you lie about your children? Which I guess...
You know, after our daughter-in-law was accused, I thought, you know, she is so calm. She's like oil on water. When she's around, she can walk in a coffee shop, and a little baby will be screaming and yelling to say, oh, what a sweet baby, can I hold him? And calling the baby right down. You know, she was incredible with kids. And I thought, you know, if I had been accused, I have yelled at my husband before. I have never heard a raised voice in their home.
Right.
But I would be so much more, they could find so much more against me just because I'm a little more, you know, volatile or whatever. You know, sometimes I'll say...
You're not Italian, are you?
I'm doing that or whatever, you know. And they would use everything against you. Everything
that
anybody ever said or did.
Okay, so we're kind of coming to the end. Are there some organizations or websites that you would recommend that people could follow up this this issue more?
Actually, a really good blog is Sue Lutner, And it was a friend of hers that was accused way back in the 90s, so she's been involved in this for a long time. And it's on SBS, onsbs.org, I think.
So Sue Lutner. I'll see if I can find the link, and I'll put it in the show notes.
And, you know, you could maybe interview her as well, because she's been involved in this for the longest time of anybody on the defense side, because it was a good friend of hers that was accused. And, you know, she started questioning, and so anyway. But also there's the Innocence Network now has a shaken baby syndrome fellow. So if someone is accused, you want the attorneys to get a hold of Kate Judson. And then the Medill Innocence or the Medill Justice Project has college-level journalism students are doing reports and interviews and so on and following some cases and trying to find out what's true with regards to shaken baby syndrome. The person who first suggested that retinal hemorrhaging and subdural hemorrhaging was related to shaking and that that might explain why some of these children didn't have external injuries when it was assumed to be trauma. Subdurals may not be traumatic, but they've always been assumed to be traumatic in origin. Dr. Norman Guthkelch just died at the age of 102 or so, and when he found out what was going on, he did everything he could to try to, he said, you know, just because it could be shaking doesn't mean it is shaking.
Right. So
and he said he believes that a lot of innocent people, on the basis of the paper he wrote back in 1971, have been wrongly accused. And so that's that, you know, he's an authority.
Right, right.
But, yeah.
Well, thank you for spending some time with me today. It sounds from your story that you and your family went through hell and back, but you came out okay in the end.
Yes, but I'll tell you, it was there but for God's grace. She could have had a life sentence like many people do.
I mean, even what you went through, I mean, it can sound like, you know, 2 years in jail. That's
a lot. Bankruptcy, all those things, you know.
Right?
I mean, it's one of the worst things that can happen, even in a best-case scenario. Even
yes.
If you're acquitted, you're bankrupt, usually.
Like if you have to spend $50,000 or $100,000 on defending yourself at the end, it's like, okay, now you're free, but you've lost your house and
you've lost everything.
You've lost your job, probably.
Your college funds.
Yes, yes.
Everything.
Yeah, devastating. And there's no program to help people when the state takes all that away from you, and then at the end it's like, sorry.
Yeah.
There's
well,
nothing.
They don't even say sorry usually.
they don't even say sorry.
You got away, but next time we're gonna for sure win. You know.
Don't ever, you know, ride your bicycle on the sidewalk again because we'll get you. Okay, well, thank you very much, and I'll send you a link to the podcast after the show is broadcast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 135 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, and follow us on Twitter and Instagram @InfectiousMyth. Until next week, goodbye.